That's against the harmonies of Sweet Honey and the Rock from Africans in America. And it seemed apropos to introduce our next piece. Virtually no part of the modern United States, the economy, education, constitutional law, religious institutions, sports, literature, economics, even protest movements can be understood without first understanding the slavery and dispossession that laid its foundation. And as I so want myself to root out of the soil America's original sin of slavery and the dispossession of indigenous people, the ultimate impediment to realizing the promise of democracy, I picked up yet another one of Dr. Gerald Horn's books that changes the narrative and writes Africans and their descendants and people who are indigenous to this land back in a fundamental way into our history. He tells it like it is and as we must hear it. And so I've tackled Dr. Horn's apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean, where Gerald Horn digs deeply into Europe's colonization of Africa and the New World, when from Columbus's arrival until the Civil War, some 13 million Africans and some 5 million Native Americans were forced to build and cultivate a society extolling liberty and justice for all. A prolific author, Dr. Gerald Horn has written dozens of books on a wide range of neglected, but by no means marginal or minor episodes of world history. He writes about topics he perceives as misrepresented struggles for justice, in particular communist struggles and struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, racism, and white supremacy. And it is an absolute pleasure to represent with Dr. Gerald Horn, really a national treasure, and have the discussion now about one of his newest works. Because I can't even say his newest book because I know he's already in the progress of another one. But good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So as I was saying, I've constantly, as I've become conscious and want to become more conscious, grappled with this question of the roots of white supremacy. And your book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism, talk about, indeed, that foundational reality, which was certainly not truth, justice, and the American way, on the evolution of the development of America and the development of American capitalism. How did white supremacy become fundamental, and what is its root in the soil that still has to be torn out?
Well, at the beginning of the 17th century, that is to say the early 1600s, England in some ways was a failed state. By the end of the 17th century, that is to say the end of the 1600s, it was well on its way to being the reigning global superpower, a status it held fundamentally up until the end of World War II. And as I tell the story, that amazing transformation was rooted in no small part on the dispossession of the indigenous populations of the Caribbean and North America, and, of course, the institution of slavery. Now, with regard to whiteness or white supremacy, what I try to show is that this was a kind of identity politics a militarized identity politics. That is to say, that it was an organizing principle that was deployed to ensure that there would be a settler class who would be in sync with London as it moved to dispossess the indigenous population and in some ways enslave them and in other ways replace the indigenous population with enslaved Africans. It gave a stake in the system to those who would therefore and thereby be defined as, quote, white, unquote. Now, there are a number of signposts along this road. What I try to argue is that with regard to the rise of England and with regard to the rise of white supremacy, slavery, and capitalism, a turning point was really 1655, because it's at that point that you saw the English take over Jamaica from the Spanish, ousting them altogether, which creates more land that needs to be settled and stocked and thereby helping to attract more migrants, not only from Europe, but also from North America, from what is now called New England. But there were not simply enough English to engage in this task, and thereby you have the creation, or perhaps I should say the acceleration of this identity politics of whiteness as the migrants from North America and from Europe are attracted to the Caribbean. And at the same time, simultaneously, you see that a population that had migrated from Holland to Brazil to engage in the production of sugar, that is to say, Jewish migrants who had been chased out of the Iberian Peninsula post-1492 and had found sanctuary in Holland, and then after the Dutch had ousted the Portuguese temporarily from Brazil, they came there to produce sugar through slave labor, but then the Portuguese made a comeback in 1654, and what happens is that that population of Jewish refugees then began to flee to the Caribbean, taking their technology and the knowledge that they have in producing sugar through enslaved labor to Jamaica. That leads to the sugar boom, tremendous wealth flowing into the coffers of London, which then allows London to build a bigger navy, which it then uses to oust the Dutch from Manhattan, where you are now sitting, and from what are now the Middle Atlantic states of the United States of America. That leads further in 1672 to the formation of the Royal African Company under the thumb of the monarch, that is to say, the systematizing of the African slave trade. But then that's creating so much wealth that the merchant class wants to get in on the action. And so by 1688, they clip the wings of the monarch in the so-called Glorious Revolution and then enter the African slave trade, that is to say, the merchants. And that leads to a quantum leap forward in the African slave trade, creating even more wealth, but also creating more disgruntled Africans, particularly in the Caribbean. Keep in mind that up until the middle of the 18th century, London thought that the Caribbean was more valuable than the North American colonies. But what happens in the Caribbean is that the Africans are outnumbering the Europeans. They're revolting. They're chasing the Europeans to the North American mainland, what is now the United States of America. And then, as I tell the story in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, that leads to the revolt against London in 1776, leading to the formation of the United States of America.
One of the things that I want to drill deeply into, you know, the spirit of 1676, the identity politics of whiteness. And this is a chapter that you have, the prelude to colonial secession. If you could talk about that.
Well, 1676, a mere century before the revolt against British rule in 1776, leading to the formation of the United States, 1676 is a real turning point. On the one hand, you have these tumultuous revolts of the enslaved in the Caribbean that are fundamentally threatening the entire colonial project based upon enslavement of Africans. Then, of course, in New England, you have the indigenous population on the warpath, which is also threatening the future viability and stability of the colonial project in what is now called New England. And then in Virginia, you have Bacon's Rebellion. That is to say, a revolt of mostly Europeans, although not exclusively Europeans. And they're revolting because they feel that the colonial overlords are not moving in a sufficiently aggressive way to dispossess the Native Americans and turn the land over to them, that is to say, the poor Europeans. Now, this has been a staple of the attempt to try to understand colonial America and also the roots of the United States. Oftentimes, even by our friends on the left, it's been portrayed as this righteous revolt of those who are defined as white against the elite. Oftentimes swept under the rug is the fact that the basis for the revolt was that they thought that the elite were not moving fast enough to dispossess the Native Americans. I try to tell a different story, that is to say that what happens as a direct result of this Bacon's Rebellion, this revolt of the European dispossessed, is that even though the revolt is ultimately crushed, their aims are not crushed, and there does arise an accelerated attempt to expropriate the Native Americans of their land, and this helps to accelerate the genocide against the Native Americans, and also it helps to create a kind of class collaboration, which has not been defeated to this very day, between and amongst those of European descent who are defined as, quote, white, unquote, a kind of class collaboration that you see in U.S. politics in 2018, and that you can also espy in the November 2016 election of one Donald J. Trump as U.S. president.
The identity politics of whiteness, is that, do you see that as evolving primarily as a moral, ethical, a perverse moral, ethical excuse to continue the enslavement? Is that how we are to understand the evolution of white supremacy? Or is it more fundamental than just an attitudinal component to justify what was essentially an economic system that was put into place?
Well, I think you have to understand settler colonialism. Settler colonialism was not only unfolding in North America, pivoted on this premise of the construction of whiteness, it was also unfolding, you may recall, beginning in 1652 at the southern tip of Africa. It also unfolded in Algeria in the 19th century, that is to say, proposed and projected by French colonialists. And I think it's fair to say that settler colonialism, which is premised upon this idea of the identity politics of whiteness, is a very stubborn foe to try to overcome, not least because it helps to provide incentives for poor Europeans to go along with the program of settler colonialism, because from their point of view, they can benefit from the dispossession of the Native Americans. I mean, if you fast forward to the early 19th century, for example, and you see the allotment of land, like even in the Homestead Act, which is oftentimes celebrated even by friends on the left in the 1860s, whereby land is given out to poor Europeans, well, I mean, that was the land of Native Americans. And so, obviously, it provides an incentive to kind of go along with the program. And I think that, obviously, the election of Trump should have led to a total retelling of the narrative of U.S. history. It should have led to an agonizing reappraisal of what historians have told us about U.S. history. But I have not detected that. But I do think that when that story is finally retold in an adequate fashion, we'll probably come to the conclusion that there were a number of factions amongst the European population defined as white. Of course, the faction that we tend to cling to is that symbolized by the great John Brown, the Euro-American man who tried to lead a revolt against slavery. But John Brown was a minority, with that is to say, it would be a mistake to see him as somehow symbolic of the entire Euro-American population. I think that there was a pro-slavery faction, as embodied in George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, that is to say, those who founded the United States of America, with the Africans being opposed, and one of the reasons why the black population has suffered so tremendously is because of this opposition to the slaveholders' republic. But then there is oftentimes called a so-called anti-slavery faction, but I think that that's sort of misleading and a misnomer, because if you look at the abolition of slavery in the Northeast, for example, in Vermont in the 1770s, this was not just a movement against slavery, it was a movement towards the so-called white man's country. And if you look at the formation of the state of Oregon in the 1850s, where no Negroes were fundamentally allowed, that's a further illustration of this principle of the white man's country. And if you look at U.S. politics today, for example, if you look at the academic departments that are fundamentally all white, if you look at this discourse that tends to try to defame the black liberation movement by seeing it as some sort of identity politics, to use that derisive term, you see that this idea of the white man's country, which I would also say is fundamentally imbricated in liberalism, has yet to be defeated, not least because it is yet to be critically examined. And I would say going forward in the 21st century, that'll be one of the fundamental tasks of scholars and historians.
And I dare say there's several books that will be forthcoming from you on that. And we are speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn about one of his new works, Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. And one of the other very insightful and important pieces, there are many, of course, within this book, was the issue of the roughly 2 to 4 million Native Americans who were enslaved and traded by European settlers in the Americas, English and Scots, not least. Talk about that.
Well, there's been a lot of new scholarship, fortunately, on the enslavement of Native Americans and the Native American slave trade. Christopher Columbus, who we all know, one of his major jobs once he landed in this hemisphere was transporting enslaved indigenous populations all over the globe, in fact. Indeed, this was a major project of the original colonizers. You'll now find a Native American DNA in virtually every corner of planet Earth because they were shipped all around the world. In fact, they were shipped indeed to Africa. So this is one of the many crimes that have been inflicted upon the indigenous population. And once again, I think that you can't begin to understand this crisis that we are now faced with the rise of Donald J. Trump, unless you begin to try to retell the story of how Donald J. Trump got 63 million votes, almost all of them from those defined as white, and many of them presumably voting against their class interests, underline presumably, because many of them feel that the clock of history can be turned back. That is to say, the movement against Jim Crow segregation that accelerates in the 1950s can be reversed, and you can return to a time of the Homestead Act, for example, just referenced, whereby Europeans can profit across the board, irrespective of class origins, based upon the expropriation of other populations. Now, myself, and I'm sure yourself and many in your audience, will be fighting like hell to ensure that that does not happen. But the fact that that question is now on the table, I think, bespeaks how we need a new story of how we got to this point.
For sure. I want to continue with the issue of your understanding of how white supremacy implants itself and takes hold in the psyche, in the attitude, and becomes a policy and indeed institutionalized within this country. To what extent there's a classic kind of left position that it was largely as a way of separating African labor, dividing the working class, if you will, by virtue of the evolution or the development or the nurturance of the philosophic premise of issues of white supremacy, of white supremacy, and indeed, which of course developed into eugenics movements to separate and divide indentured labor, the who was here to then the kind of nascent evolution of the white working class. Is that how you see the function and development and basis for the development of white supremacy?
Well, I see the construction of whiteness as an organizing principle. It's a way whereby you can attract Europeans to a war zone, that is to say, the Caribbean and North America in the 17th century, and attract them to a war zone so that they can help to perpetrate and perpetuate settler colonialism. I see it as fundamentally a pragmatic reaction to how do you, as you put it, separate Africans from their labor and separate Native Americans from their land. This is a mass project. And keep in mind that these colonizing countries that we're talking about are not that large. I mean, if you look at Portugal today, it has a population of about 9 million, for example. And yet, at the time that we're discussing, it was seeking to rule Brazil, which is as large as the continental United States from the Atlantic to the Pacific, excluding Alaska, trying to rule Angola and Mozambique in Africa, trying to rule ultimately Macau off the shores of China. And these indigenous European populations or nationalized populations, for example, the English, they're simply not large enough. And so you have to have a newer identity. This is also taking place in the context of religious wars, that is to say, between Catholics and Protestants, in particular the 30 Years' War, concluding in 1648, for example, leading to tremendous dispossession of Europeans and tremendous slaughter of Europeans, which also helps to perfect certain kinds of military technologies and military formations that are then deployed in Africa and in the Americas, but also providing a lesson in terms of the downside of inter-European conflict that then is translated into this new identity of whiteness that is emerging and accelerating in the 17th century. Now, if I may fast forward, because I know your audience is very much concerned about the current moment, I think that when historians of the future look back, assuming that the current president doesn't blow up planet Earth, one of the things that I think they will find intriguing is the fact that in the late 20th century, early 21st century, you had a number of Democratic writers and scholars who say that the major problem in terms of the Democratic Party gaining ascendancy is what they call identity politics, and oftentimes they mean the Black Liberation Movement. Now, this obviously obscures the fact that 9 out of 10 Black Americans usually vote for the Democratic Party. So how can, as this professor at Columbia University in the book The Once and Future Liberal argues, how can you lay Trump's victory at the doorstep of the Black community when the Black community votes against Trump 9-1? But he, of course, is not alone. There was another book, The Twilight of Common Dreams, supposedly identity politics, according to this writer, was disrupting the common dream, for example, the New Deal project. But once again, the blacks vote in favor of New Deal candidates 9-1. And then before that, the disuniting of America, where the same thesis was put forward. So I think historians will be grappling with this contradiction. Why do these Democratic Party scholars keep blaming the blacks for the rise of the Republicans when the blacks are voting against the Republicans 9-1? Well, I think that it goes back to my concept of the white man's country. That is to say, one of the differences between the pro-slavery faction of the U.S. ruling elite and the white man's country faction is that the white man's country faction, they would like us to vote. They just don't want us to complain about racism, basically. Because as they see it, complaining about racism makes white people upset. And so we have to be quiet about that. And so that's really what they're complaining about. When you had at your sister station, if I may, WNYC, a host of The Takeaway complaining that the black woman who was sitting beside him in the radio booth broadcasting should not have been there. She was a so-called diversity hire, unquote. That was once again an expression of this white man's country faction, which until we grapple with it and how it's implicated in liberalism, how it's implicated, quite frankly, in the upper reaches of the Democratic Party, we won't be able to dig ourselves out of this hole. And in order to understand that particular concept, you have to start digging deeply to begin with in the 17th century.
You know, I just constantly marvel at really the Democratic Party, who is as divorced, including even in many ways politicians like Bernie Sanders, who continue to isolate out from the question of class as though there's no fundamental and strategic component to the class question, the issue of race. They submerge it, they bury it, and it's as though the eradication of institutional racism just inherently evolves by virtue of class perspective. You've kind of really brought together in all of your works, I think, a number of issues. You deal with the kind of conjuncture, the overlay of race and class. You don't separate them out. You see them as strategic and feeding one on the other. And you also imbue the people that you are covering, whether it's the enslaved Africans, whether it is the indigenous people being dispossessed of their properties, with a very sophisticated consciousness. It is revolts that are not just visceral in nature. There are revolts that are calculated, determined, and come from one's own root understanding of human right and freedom and so on. And I wonder if you can just talk about those two different things as built into your books. And I think that terrible foible on the left, as well as most definitively in the Democratic Party, that continues to negate the issue of white supremacy, that negates the issue of race. And it's imperative still for the evolution and development of capitalism.
Well, what I find striking today in 2017 is that there is quite a bit of talk right now in certain circles about the rise of fascism in the United States of America as embodied in one Donald J. Trump. And what I find striking about that is that oftentimes the discussion has been led by members of the 1% as opposed to our friends on the left, because I think our friends on the left have been bludgeoned into accepting the creation myth of the founding of the United States in 1776 and how it was some sort of incomplete revolution that somehow set afloat these eternal principles of liberty and freedom, and which we're still struggling to apply to the rest of the population, which in many ways is saying that the enactment of apartheid in South Africa in 1948, which was designed to uplift a sector of the European minority, somehow it was an incomplete revolution that then Nelson Mandela should have been seeking to try to extend to the African majority. And when I see that a person like Michael Kinsley, a former CNN commentator, has spoken more articulately about the rise of fascism in the United States than some of our friends on the left, I find it very concerning. And just as an anecdote, I'm on the board, editorial board, of a journal that describes itself as the oldest Marxist journal in the United States of America, over 80 years old. And of late, there has been an internal discussion, not about the rise of fascism, not about the fruits of settler colonialism, not about reparations for centuries of unpaid labor to the descendants of Africans who were enslaved, or even to the African continent itself, but the debate has been about Stalin. Even though most of these people don't speak Russian, many of them have never been east of London. And I found that very curious, because it seemed to me to be a kind of evasion. Not to say that Stalin is not an important subject, but what about what's going on right now in terms of the ominous developments and ominous trends? And I think that part of the answer rests in the fact that my fellow members of that editorial board are mostly descendants of settlers, and there has been a difficulty in the settler class and their descendants in grappling with the horror of what led to their present status in the United States of America. Many of them, even those who consider themselves to be revolutionary, would prefer to see their rise as being somehow subjective, as Ann Richards once said about George H.W. Bush. He was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. And I understand that, because once one begins to grapple with the horrors of this country, it can be quite overwhelming, and it becomes easier to deal with events that happened in another country a long time ago rather than deal with the looming menace of fascism in the United States of America, which it seems to me will inevitably involve a deep excavation of the history of the United States, particularly the history of settler colonialism beginning in the 17th century.
Well, I really want to commend you, as always, for really ferreting out the story of the foundations of this country, what it's built on, recasting the narrative, bringing to light the resistance and the ideas from the people who were enslaved and dispossessed that are at similarly the foundation of building this country and giving us and imbuing us with at least the promise of democracy. Philosophically, theoretically, that's where it evolved from, not from the settlers, not from the colonialists, not from the imperialists. And you just turn it all around and set us straight. And I want to encourage people to pick up Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. There's so much meat to provide us with a much stronger foundation and theoretical basis upon which to engage in our social activism and our combating of the evils of militarism, of impoverishment, and the inequality of wealth distribution, and certainly discrimination in all of its manifestations. Dr. Gerald Horn, thanks for imparting your knowledge and for the scholarship that you put into your work. And it's Monthly Review Press. Really got to get a copy. Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. It's really nice to have you with us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Roll mighty river, roll mighty river, black mighty river, roll on. When the last rose of summer pricks my face.
The Persuasions, Black Muddy River.